Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Prospering Together, America's Citizens, Communities, and Companies. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. As I had indicated, President of the Business Roundtable, John Castellani, was unable to be with us this evening, but Larry Burton, the Executive Director of the Business Roundtable, was kind enough to actually fly out today from Washington, D.C., to be with us this evening. The Business Roundtable, cited as the most influential chief executive lobbying group in the United States by the Financial Times, its members are at the forefront of public policy, advocating for a vigorous, dynamic global economy. Business Roundtable is an association of leading U.S. chief executive officers with $4.5 trillion in annual revenues, and that might actually be a bit less now, and nearly 10 million employees. Prior to this appointment, Larry was vice president, external affairs for BP America. From 2002 to 2004, he was regional coordinator, Western Hemisphere, North America, for BP PLC, based in London. From 95 to 2001, Larry served as BP's Vice President for U.S. Government and International Affairs, based in Washington, D.C. Before joining BP in 1987, he served in various capacities in the U.S. government, including senior positions with a couple of U.S. senators, and also served in the White House Office of Management and Budget. He received his B.A. from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, and his M.B.A. from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Other interests include serving as counselor for the Meridian International Center and past president of the Business Government Relations Council. His outside interests include piano, tennis, and golf. He's married with two children, and he and his family reside in Arlington, Virginia. Please join me in welcoming Larry Burton.
Well, thank you, Tom, for those kind words, and thank you for the chance to be with you today. I didn't realize I was going to be here on Monday or Tuesday until about midday, so it's really quite a prestigious venue, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here in San Francisco. As Tom mentioned, John was called over to the White House to meet with President Obama, and that's the kind of invitation you really can't pass up, so here I am, and I'm honored to be here in John's stead. The great American philosopher Yogi Berra once said, "If you don't know where you're going, you'll wind up somewhere else." And today, Americans find themselves somewhere else. I'm here in my capacity as executive director of the Business Roundtable, which is an association of the nation's leading chief executives. Our members, like all Americans, have come together, Democrats and Republicans, to help find an urgent solution to this financial and economic crisis that is like none we have ever experienced. Business Roundtable has worked with 8 administrations since our founding. The Obama presidency, although brand new, already faces the most difficult challenges to economic growth by far. In fact, we are mired in the most perilous economic crisis any administration has confronted in my lifetime or in the lifetimes of anybody in this room. Yet, it's also a time of historic change and promise. As President Obama said so eloquently at his inauguration, I quote, "On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord." He also said, and I quote, "The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth." I applaud President Obama for the urgency he brought to Washington, D.C. and to the Congress. He cut through the rhetoric and called for action, but we'll need more of that can-do attitude to move us from recovery to sustained economic growth. Well, Congress has taken the first step by passing an economic stimulus bill. And the Business Roundtable worked with Congress for months on the package, which, as you know, grew with every passing week. And unfortunately, during that time, the program has pulled in many different directions, some good, some not so good. We commend the inclusion of several of our members' top priorities, including education and workforce training programs, worker and consumer tax relief, targeted infrastructure investments, and funding for the adoption of health information technology. But we were disappointed that the final compromise bill failed to give a boost to the housing market or incentivize business investment. Now, I was traveling today, But I have to say, I was pleased to see on the networks that, that President Obama took steps today toward addressing the housing situation. Well, now that the economic stimulus legislation is finalized, we must begin the hard work of activating the stimulus to produce jobs and grow the economy so that all Americans can enjoy better lives. The role of the business community in achieving that goal has never been more important. Well, consider just one telling statistic. The stimulus package passed by the United States Congress will pump about $800 billion into the economy, and that is a huge number. But keep in mind that the Business Roundtable companies, of which they number 160, generate more than $5 trillion in annual revenues every year. And we employ nearly 10 million people. And we're only one segment of the business community. Clearly, all government by itself cannot get our economy moving again. Business Roundtable and the rest of corporate America must play a central role, and we must find new ways to work together with government. Our CEOs understand that the future of American workers and the future of America's businesses are intertwined. As Steve Adler, who's the editor-in-chief of Business Week, recently wrote, and I quote, "The fact that smart people were wrong doesn't mean there's no value to business brain power and accumulated knowledge, not to mention innovation." So our CEOs ask themselves, in these uncertain times, what kinds of changes to policies, structures, and the economy must we have so we can compete, succeed, and grow throughout the 21st century? Well, for our economy and our country to move forward, all of us, that means business, government, and most importantly, the new administration and Congress, must put policies in place that will ensure vigorous economic growth and will ensure that we can compete with the rest of the world. As we see it, what America needs to compete in an international economy are really three things. One, a competitive workforce. Two, cost structures that make sense. And three, equitable rules to govern trade. Today I want to talk about why I think these are the right policies and how we can make them a reality. First, a competitive workforce. The American economy was built on the ingenuity and passion of our workforce. There is no better place to start than here. Indeed, if you were to ask the members of the Business Roundtable what their most valuable asset for competing and winning, they would invariably say, our employees. Yet, changes in the global economy and advances in the technology have left many Americans feeling less valued than they did before, and that is wrong. Our world has changed. Newsweek columnist Fareed Zakaria writes in his book, The Post-American World, that by 2040, five emerging market countries, China, India, Brazil, Russia, and Mexico, will together have a larger economic output than the G7 countries, the seven Western nations that have dominated global affairs for centuries. We can't change the new world order, nor do we want to. These changes have brought incredible improvements and conveniences to our lives. None of us would want to go back to an earlier time, but what we can change and what we must change is how we choose to adapt. We need to be teaching American workers the skills to succeed in the new economy. It's been said before, and I'll say it again, there is no future in any job. The future lies in the one who holds the job, and that is where we must put our resources. Our national priority should be to ensure that all Americans, from the individual just entering the workforce to the former factory worker, have the chance to win in today's economy. For young Americans planning to enter the workforce, we must provide them with the education and training that will prepare them for higher skilled service and manufacturing jobs that will characterize the economy of our future. For individuals in the workforce today, no matter their education, profession, or age, we need to emphasize the importance of lifelong learning so that as our economy evolves, our workforce will be positioned to stay ahead of the curve. And for those who have suffered the very real pain and loss of a job, which is more than 3.6 million Americans since the recession began, I think 2 million in just 2008 alone, we need to provide an avenue to help them get back on their feet and show them a new path to prosperity. This is particularly important here in California, which lost 257,000 jobs in 2008, more than any other state in the United States of America. American workers need to know that when their job is no longer there, the United States will be there, to help them learn the new skills to rebound and succeed. Most of the focus of the economic stimulus package has been on the size and shape of projects involved. But even the best structured package will fail if America doesn't have the workers needed to fill the new jobs. Moreover, after any near-term recovery, American workers must have the skills and training to qualify them for the jobs of the 21st century. Right now, American taxpayers spend more than $130 billion on worker training and adjustment assistance. Unfortunately, that spending is divided among a bewildering array of sometimes overlapping programs. Overall training programs are not helping workers enough to acquire knowledge, skills, and the support they need. Workers would be much better served, for example, if the government would consolidate access for all training, assistance, and education programs. At the very least, workers should have a one-click, easy-to-use, consumer-friendly program. That's why last week, the Business Roundtable announced the formation of the Springboard Project. This is a new commission. It will be composed of leading thinkers from education, business, government, foundations, labor, and the online world. It will have its formal launch next month, so you're getting a bit of a sneak preview. Its focus will be to help prepare workers for the 21st century jobs, those created by the stimulus package and those that come after. One asset the commission will be examining is our nation's network of 1,200 community colleges, which are a valuable resource that should be tapped to support the changing needs of our workforce and our changing economy. With 80% of the fastest growing jobs in the United States requiring a post-secondary degree, we should enhance the capacity of these institutions, like the City College of San Francisco, to educate locally for a global economy. Let me turn now to the second major policy area, which relates to sustainable cost pressures. Just as our workforce must adapt to remain competitive, so must our nation's cost structures, specifically when it comes to health care and energy. Today, our health care system is broken. The reality is that my office equipment is more sophisticated than the system we depend on to support our health. Think about that for a second. As a consequence, not only can we not afford it, but we can't even provide coverage for everyone. In Stephen Greenhouse's book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, he writes that from 2000 to 2006, the number of Americans without health insurance climbed by 8.6 million people to 47 million people. One study found that more than two-fifths of moderate-income, working-age Americans went without health insurance for at least part of 2005. In California alone, 7 million people are uninsured. 7 million people in the state of California are uninsured. Businesses agree, until we can solve this crisis, and it is a crisis, our cost will whittle away our competitive edge. The good news is, solutions exist. And there's a growing will among business and labor to enact them. Some of you may have seen the coalition that we're involved with called Divided We Fail. It's a coalition of AARP, the Service Employees Union, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, and the Business Roundtable. And the whole purpose is to say to policymakers, let's figure this out. Let's figure out the healthcare situation and get some answers. Well, contrary to what some might say, our CEOs don't want to get out of the healthcare, don't want to get out of the business of healthcare. We want to be part of the solution. We second what many health policy analysts will tell you, that the only way forward with healthcare is through a public-private partnership. What is needed now is for the government to join us. So let's talk about solutions. A first step, and it's a huge one, set standards for health information technology. This was part of the recently passed stimulus bill that the president just signed. And you know, it's interesting, you know, if you look at our cars that we have today, I drive a car. I have more information from my car on maintenance and diagnostics than I have really accessible to me from my doctor. So I want to be treated as well as my car. We need that information. It's critical for decision-making. By building a system for health IT, we can help doctors, patients, and hospitals share information freely and securely. It's just one example of a fix that will not only lower our cost, but leave us with a healthcare system that is focused on quality healthcare. What else can we do? Well, Business Roundtable believes that there are four critical healthcare reform challenges, and I'll state them simply. First, we need to get greater consumer value out of our healthcare system. This includes using the health information technology and empowering consumers with more information about good quality healthcare. Second, we need to create a more affordable health insurance options for America. By creating an open, all-inclusive private market for health insurance that would replace today's highly fragmented state-by-state market, broader, more competitive markets will create more choices for more healthcare consumers. Third, we need to engage all Americans and ensure they are taking an active role in their healthcare. All Americans should obtain health insurance, either through their employer or through the private market. There should also be an individual obligation to do so. We need to encourage Americans to participate in employers or community-based prevention, wellness, and chronic care programs. Fourth, if people can't afford it, then we must offer assistance to the uninsured, low-income families to meet that obligation. And this assistance could be financed from the cost savings and efficiencies generated by a more competitive and value-driven healthcare system. So there's a way to do it. For our part, the members of the Business Roundtable are committed to continuing to offer health insurance coverage to our workers. We hope all employers will do so, especially as we push for reforms to bring down costs, create more affordable insurance options, and assistance for those individuals who can't afford coverage. Like healthcare, I'm going to move on, energy costs are straining the budgets of American families and businesses. In the last 4 years, the price of a barrel of oil had nearly doubled. It has eased in the past few months, but make no mistake about it. When the economy recovers, so will energy prices. And this means that businesses have less money to invest in new jobs, in better pay, and in benefits for their employees. Moreover, as prices increase, our energy supplies have become increasingly uncertain. But again, like healthcare, it's a challenge we have the power to solve. For if there's one thing I know, it's that American enterprise has the intellect and the drive to help us meet our energy needs. And we can do it in a way that protects the environment, strengthens our economy, and provides long-term security for our nation. But only if we have the right policies in place. For starters, we can and should expand access to oil and gas reserves that, because of ill-conceived government policies, are off-limits. There's no reason why we should continue to depend on oil from abroad while we ignore the stockpile sitting in our own backyard. The fact of the matter is, we have the technology to ensure our coastline, and the surrounding habitat remains pristine tomorrow as it is today. Give us the toughest environmental standards, and we will meet them. At the same time, we should also diversify our supply by focusing on coal gasification, biomass, renewables, and nuclear energy. Yes, we will still depend on coal and liquid fuel for the foreseeable future, but now is the time to start depending in a meaningful way on other sources as well. Lastly, we can set more aggressive goals for energy efficiency and intensity. Over the years, we've made some incremental improvements. If you look at 1970, it took more than one barrel of oil to produce $1,000 of the GDP. Today, it takes far less. If we put our minds to it, it's conceivable that by 2025, we can increase U.S. energy efficiency by another 40%. Is this the total solution? Absolutely not. But there's some of the steps we can start taking today to secure our future, protect our resources, and ultimately sustain the strength of our economy. I now want to talk about the final piece of the plan for prosperity, which really deals with providing for a system of fair rules, fair and free trade. What do I mean by that? Well, simply put, it means that the U.S. must demand that other countries treat our companies and our workers fairly. We are a player, among many, in an international economy. Having a role on the international stage is good for our country. We all know that our lifestyles have been made richer by products that we can afford because of trade with countries like China. But even more important is the fact that exports made by American workers pump hundreds of billions of dollars into our nation's economy. These are things that you may not even think about, things like heavy machinery, computer hardware, financial services, insurance, medical equipment. and other items that countries depend on Americans to provide. Excuse me. Our economy depends deeply on that demand. One out of every five jobs in the United States relies on the fact that there are customers overseas waiting to buy American products and services. In 1992, it was one out of 10. So we made that even more connection with the rest of the world in the past 15, 17 years. In fact, 95% of the world's customers are outside of the United States. Clearly, being a player in the international economy is important to our economy. It is also important for your state. In 2007, California exported $134 billion worth of goods, second only to Texas in terms of total exports. Over one-fifth of all manufacturing workers in California depend on exports for their jobs. We must ensure that U.S. workers have every opportunity to compete in the international economy freely and fairly. And let me ask you, is it fair to hold American companies back while other countries compete? Of course it's not, but we are. As we speak, and this number is staggering, there are 300 free trade agreements that are being negotiated around the world. Do you know how many are being negotiated where the United States is a party? 14. And I'll give you an example of what that means for jobs in this country. A couple of years ago, it was cheaper for one of our members, Caterpillar, to make their equipment in Canada and then export that equipment to Chile rather than make it in their headquarters in the United States. Why? Well, it's because Canada had a free trade agreement with Chile and the United States did not. Fortunately, today, we do have a trade agreement with Chile. But the fact is, we can't expect to be a world leader in today's international economy by sitting on the sidelines. As in the case of Caterpillar, which makes clear, we need to get involved in every single trade agreement that makes sense for us, for our values, and for our workforce. In addition to establishing clear and open trade channels, we must also look at the larger global regulatory environment. Reforms are required to ensure oversight of our increasingly complex global financial services sector, which has outgrown the regulatory process of individual governments. We support prudent, smart regulatory reform for financial services that is globally consistent. Winston Churchill once said, and I quote, "Let our advanced worrying become advanced thinking and planning," end of quote. It's true that many Americans are worried about the future of our economy and our nation's ability to compete in the world tomorrow. At its heart, we all know that our future can be better. America's businesses know it can be better. With a competitive workforce, cost structures we can sustain, and rules that are fair, we see a way forward. We see an opportunity to secure our future and provide a better way of life for every American. But how do we translate these ideas into action? The Business Roundtable CEOs have spent months producing concrete recommendations on how both to respond to the current crisis and to make sure that we are on the path to continued long-term growth. The recommendations are based on diligent research and the deep knowledge and best practices of each of our members. Last week, we sent these recommendations to Congress in a briefing book called Effective Leadership on the World Stage, CEO Memos to Congress. Looks like this. And actually, if you're interested in it, you can look it up on our website at www.businessroundtable.org. It outlines our entire agenda, which gives more specifics on the recommendations, some of the issues I've touched on tonight. In closing, we are at an historic crossroads today. Our children and grandchildren will read about the actions we take this week and next, and history will determine if we did enough, if we acted quickly enough, if we acted boldly enough. The Business Roundtable will not be a bystander to this economic crisis. The economy is deteriorating faster than we had imagined, and we must do everything possible to stem the ever-increasing loss of jobs. The success of the final economic stimulus bill will be determined by execution. We have a proven track record of success and innovation. We've pledged to work with the President's team and Congress to ensure that the stimulus achieves its goals. The American people are skeptical of government spending. And we must ensure that the work does not end with just the signing of a piece of legislation, but with jobs being filled and projects completed in an efficient, cost-effective manner. Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the plans we believe will strengthen our economy and get us back on track to prosperity for many years to come. It's an honor to be here, and I'll give John Castellani your regards when I return to Washington. I'm happy to answer any questions, Tom.
Well, let's put our hands together for Larry Burton. So we have been listening to Larry Burton, who is the executive director of the Business Roundtable out of Washington, D.C., an organization of some of the largest companies in America. I think you had mentioned, Larry, over 160 or so members. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And we love to, as we go into the Q&A period, we love to kind of probe and poke provocative ideas here at the Commonwealth Club. So if we have some questions that put you on the spot, and we can certainly understand that all of them may not necessarily be answerable by you or whatever. But and I'll lead off with this one. What is the Business Roundtable's position on this question of socialism versus capitalism that seems to be being talked about a lot? I don't know that our economy has ever necessarily been or at least in recent times, a pure capitalistic state. We've been kind of a hybrid of sorts. But what are your comments, or what are the kinds of things you hear around the halls of the Business Roundtable and within the, I mean, is kind of capitalism on the ropes right now? Or are we moving to, I think it was Joseph Schumpeter, by the way, and back in the 1930s, famed economist who coined the term creative destruction. He was one who said that he loved capitalism, but he felt that it was inevitably moving toward socialism. And I don't know. Seems like there's been a bigger and bigger role for government. But anyway, what about the Business Roundtable?
Well, I'm not a philosopher, so I will not get into the isms, but I will respond in this way. The we are in uncharted waters. We've never been in this situation before. People look at, you know, they look at the benchmark in the 1930s, and they looked at previous recessions. You've had economists say we're in the third longest recession since the Depression. We're in uncharted territory. So I think it's fair to say that the members of the Business Roundtable have supported this extraordinary act of government intervention going back into the September-October timeframe. It was necessary to prevent financial crisis. And so even though no one knew what the outcome might be, we knew that someone had to act, and so we supported that intervention. The question now is, how do we actually get back into sort of normal business? And one of the actions we're going to have to be working on is, how do you construct that framework, policy framework, so that business can conduct itself in the United States and globally in a way that manages risk in a fair way, the way that people understand how the system works. I think that there were so many creative mechanisms that were not fully understood in the financial sector by those in the industry, let alone those regulators, that we have to take a step back and try to put it in the right framework once again. So we support working with government. The one good thing out of this is we believe, the CEOs of the Business Roundtable believe that that there's confidence in the economy, that there's confidence in government to do the right thing, and that at the end of the day, we will get back into a situation where we have growth and jobs in this economy.
So I know our audience, and we do have ample time for questions, so if I may just take the prerogative to follow on with a second question quickly, and as our audience gets their questions and raises their hands, I'd like to ask this question, if you would respond, please. When I look at, when I consider some of the data that you've shared with us about the Business Roundtable, again, I think $4 to $5 trillion in annual revenue, and I'm not sure I have my arithmetic exactly right, but that's roughly a sixth or so, say 16 to 20% of the total GDP, I believe. I think you Americans' GDP is 25-ish trillion. And with 10 million-ish employees within your 160-some membership, and I saw a number the other day that said the private sector employees in America is around 120 million, roughly, and another 20 million in government, if you will, give or take. So my question is, what's the Business Roundtable's sense of its own relevance relative to the business world per se? And kind of related to that is the Business Roundtable's view of small business. You know, there's various numbers that float around that says there's roughly 8 to 10 million small businesses, small, medium business enterprises, SMBs, or I forget how they say that. But anyway, the real bulk of America's economy is found in small business, whether it be the sole entrepreneur or you know, smaller business. So anyway, talk if you would a little bit about how the Business Roundtable sees itself with regard to being, I don't know, spokespeople for the business community in general, because maybe not, I hear you talk about healthcare, for example, and maybe not all small businesses would necessarily say that they'd like to continue providing healthcare. And so I'm just wondering if that's just one small example, well, not small, but just one example of where small business and gigantic business may not see eye to eye. But talk a little bit, if you would, about how the Business Roundtable views itself relative to small business in America.
Okay. I'll do my best. If I miss bits and pieces of the of responding, bring me back. I think the Business Roundtable CEOs see themselves as very relevant to proposing ideas and solutions to get the economy going again. And that's, you have to earn it. You can't just assert it. You have to earn it. That means talking about it, having a plan, putting your investments, you know, that you're talking about forward. It's about collaborating with governments and communities and workers and employees and shareholders. They have to earn it. But I think they have the experience over the past number of years and decades to identify the potential solution set. As you talked about small business, hugely important to the American fabric of our economy. We have to make sure that the tax structures and the fiscal regimes and the opportunities for small businesses are there so they can grow and prosper. We have to make sure that the framework, the business framework, whether it's the state level or the community level or the federal level, works for small business. On the issue of small business and healthcare that you alluded to, you can't fix healthcare for only one segment of the population. You have to fix it for everybody. If you can't just fix it for small business, and you can't just fix it for big business. This is about fixing it for everyone. So we're thankful they're partners with us in our Divided We Fail coalition, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which are largely small businesses, are part of that collaboration. The point is, no one part of the economy will be able to fix the problems. We're going to have to roll up our sleeves and, as many of our members talk about, public-private partnerships, working together with government, with each other, with big business and small business. But you have to earn it every day. You have to earn it every quarter. You have to make money, and you also have to be good citizens. You have to do it all. And the Business Roundtable CEOs are ready and willing and able and confident that they can be constructive participants going forward. I hope that was responsive.
Just want to remind our audience, we're listening to Larry Burton, who's Executive Director of Business Roundtable. And now, audience questions?
Yes, I have a question. You said one of the solutions for business would be to increase productivity. So my question is, shouldn't every business in America have a copy of the book of Edward Deming? Deming, who focus on quality instead of quantity, and he also says that a company should be careful not to have too many managers controlling the work of those who are producing something. So I think a copy of Edward Deming would help America a lot. The other question I have is one of credibility. One of the biggest American exports are financial services. And in Brazil, for example, four large companies bought securities backed by American homes. And now they are in a very difficult situation. So I'm wondering here is if it's the problem of the credibility of the financial system is not hurting the economy, and that a true out investigation as soon as possible should be done.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out again how to respond to your question because some of it I didn't quite catch. Quality and quantity, you need both. You need quality and you need quantity. And you need mechanisms to ensure both. So that's point number one. Can you repeat your question about managers and employees?
Yes. What I read about Deming is that he believed in empowering the worker. And instead of having too many managers, giving bonus based on quantity of work, not quality of services and products. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows that Deming was the person who helped rebuild Japan. And Japan had a reputation of good quality products. I think that, unfortunately, the financial service developed too fast in relation to the real economy, it seems to me. And I just would like to see if you agree. That's one point, but the point of quality and the point of just giving bonus to those who actually contributed to the profit of a company, not just because they are managers or they are in a powerful position within the company, because they actually increase or helped to increase the productivity of the workers. I'd like to hear your opinion about that.
Okay. Well, workers are the people, employees. They're the backbone of what makes the system work. And so we have to be very respectful of their contribution to the overall economy or to any sector. And you're right. There should be systems in place to make sure you don't have too many managers and not enough people who are actually contributing. So I agree with that. I think your point about financial services and sort of the extraordinary risk that were taken and what's that mean, I think everybody agrees that something needs to be done sooner rather than later in financial regulatory reform. It cannot only be done in just one country alone. I guess it's a place to start, and we're going to certainly have our share of hearings and activities and actions, and we have our own sort of suggestions, but we really need to get our arms around that whole situation of financial regulatory reform, which we support and will be deeply engaged in. We want to make sure that the changes are smart and they're prudent and that they deal with and they're globally consistent, as I believe I said in my remarks. But what does that mean? You have to sort of take a lot of smart people and figure out how you actually understand the lessons learned from the breakdowns that occurred. And it affected not only people on Wall Street or the financial centers of the world, it affected people in this room. I mean, everybody's 401k, which is now I call it a 1k or a 10k or something that's less than a 401k. I mean, we need to figure out ways to make sure that the system works a lot better in the future than it has in the past. In terms of pay, we have principles for executive compensation that we believe strongly about pay for performance, looking at the interest of the shareholders and long-term value. We need to actually, and I really recommend if you haven't, it's on our website. I'd go look at it. Pay for performance, but in the whole quest to revisit where we are and to update where we are, risk is still important in the equation, in the economy. You have to provide for risk, but you don't want people taking unnecessary risks, because they think they're going to get extraordinary rewards. So it's about achieving that right balance. And if you have the right processes in place, particularly in a public company, where typically you have a lead director that looks at compensation and you have a mechanism that's transparent so people understand how compensation is constructed and what people are being rewarded for, you can balance. You need to have that risk in the equation. So you allow innovation, but you don't want people taking unnecessary risks. And I'll stop there. Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm a long-term member of the Commonwealth Club, and I want to tell you how grateful I am that you came out here to speak to us and to communicate to us. I'm wondering, will we be able to get a CD of this? Oh, that's great. Let's see, what was the other question? Oh, yeah, do you have a book that we can buy that lays out what you just said?
Well, we have, I'm going to write a book later on in my life. I think you're writing a book over here, I think,
All right,
point.
Let me tell you where
I do have this, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to send for that.
Well, you can actually look up on the website if you want to actually,
I wrote that down. Okay. The website,
right.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell you where I differ with you, and I hope that you're open to debate. I think that the CEOs and the business leaders of the world who have established successful companies have a much better technology-assisted learning system than public education. And so I would debate with you that I don't think business has to go to government and say, tell us how to be creative. I think business has to now make room to help government in every way possible. But I do think that the real educational breakthroughs are going to come through on-the-job training and the search for tomorrow's leaders. So do you see our difference there?
Well, actually, I don't. I see a bridge more than a difference.
I think talking about indoctrination. That's what the government does, and I'm talking about education.
Well, I'm talking about collaboration.
Okay.
And we need the DNA from the different experiences that professionals have around the matter of education, training, whatever you want to call it. We need to find a better word than training, but it's lifelong learning, I think, is a much better phrase. And I mentioned this springboard project, which is pretty exciting. And what it's really meant is to give people a springboard rather than a safety net. It allows them to sort of figure out where they can access themselves, how to get the skills to compete for jobs of the century. And we don't have the answer, but we know that if you put a bunch of smart people together, you can actually probably get to a better place than you are today. So what we're doing is we're putting together a commission. We're going to we have actually talked to some people in California, yet to be named. I can't tell you who they are, although I know at least one person. We're going to try to get people from local communities, labor, business, people with community experience, from education, from community colleges, from universities, people who have been living their whole lives thinking about this problem in maybe their silo, but actually this is an opportunity to have a conversation across silos to give the CEOs of the Business Roundtable a platform of possibilities so they can actually suggest policies to government leaders to say, you know what, good intentions, I know you have some resources out there on the matter of lifelong learning, training, etc. Here are our views, in words of one syllable, about how policies should be and programs should be constructed so people can access them in a fairly easy way. That's the whole idea. So hopefully that's responsive to your comment.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisella, and I did spend a few hours looking at your website and downloaded the letter you sent to President-elect Obama back in early January 8th. And I commend you for the letter and the recommendations. I'm a little queasy about because I'm not an expert on the goals and objectives of the Business Roundtable when it comes to capitalism and business enterprise. But my question has to deal with the fact that I'm a veteran. Currently, for the last 30 years, I work for a large nonprofit hospital, and we have medical information technology that's world class, but it's still got lots of bugs. But I've been experiencing that for 4 years. But I'm here to represent the veterans, and I volunteered to be in the Air Force, and then a year later
I'm an Air Force brat.
A year later I experienced the Yom Kippur War and the OPEC oil embargo, and it occurred to me then that we needed a youth energy corps like the Civilian Conservation Corps during the Depression, and that I strongly felt that we were going to end up going to war in the Persian Gulf over our oil dependency. And then in 79, while I was going to school here at San Jose State, studying philosophy and psychology and some other topics, I learned of a bill that was in the Congress to set up a national youth service program and replace the selective service program. And to me, it was an excellent template for lots of these concerns you've expressed. Unfortunately, for the last 30 years, I felt like I've been in a silo because most politicians, most corporate leaders, most academic professors seem to have a very narrow view of this, and they can't see the more comprehensive benefits of it as lifelong learning. But the key component was having males and females register at 17 challenged them to make decision-making processes of thinking about what does it mean to be a citizen and be a part of the community, and then at 18 indicate yes, no, or maybe towards volunteering for a variety of community service programs or military service. Okay, the question is, Obama supports expansion of CURE programs like AmeriCorps. He wants to get Senior Corps and AARP heavily involved in this. And then there's another thing called service learning for K through 12, and he has that meshed together. The one thing he has not responded to is this idea of replacing the Selective Service Program with this enhanced registration program where youth would be challenged to think about it and consider volunteering to do it. The cost of that would be a few million dollars to set it up using the internet and using that to hold everything accountable. But if you have a large number of youth volunteering, 1.5 million youth for 1 year of service, you're talking about multiple billions of dollars. Now, it used to be that was a lot of money, but the question is, can you bring that idea to the business roundtable, have them vet it and consider it, discuss it, and then consider presenting it to the people in Washington, D.C. to better understand it?
Well, thank you very much. Here, what I'd like to do is afterwards, let me give you my card, and if you have any materials you can share with me, I will get it to our director who is actually leading this Springboard project. And once the commission members are named, if you know any of them, it might be good to get into that bilateral conversation with one or two of them, so they can be, they can bring that into the commission conversation. Because ultimately, we're going to have a product of policy recommendations, and it would be great. Again, different people, not all from Washington, D.C., hardly anybody from Washington, D.C., hopefully. And hopefully we'll get ideas like this that we haven't thought about before that make a tremendous amount of sense and make a difference in people's lives. Thank you for your question.
In the text of your talk, you mentioned best practices. My question is, how does the Business Roundtable encourage its members to execute best practices? And what were the conversations going on 2004 through 2006 at roundtable meetings concerning pay for performance and also excessive leverage?
Okay, best practices, a couple of points on that. One is, the CEOs meet quarterly, and so that's an opportunity in an informal way for them to exchange, issues that are confronting them in each of their organizations, for them to look at topics. We have five initiatives, if you've had a chance to go on our website, five policy initiatives for them to have a conversation about, whether it's health and consumer health and retirement or international engagement or corporate leadership or sustainable growth or education. I mean, there are different ways to have best practice conversations in an informal sense. We also are a founding member of the Institute for Corporate Ethics, which is housed at the University of Virginia Darden School of Business and has a collaboration with, I forgot how many, business schools around the country, where there are periodic seminars that CEOs can attend and hear from the leading academic thinkers on ethics and challenges facing corporations and how best to address those sorts of issues. Second part of your question had to do with 2004 to 2006. I joined the Business Roundtable in 2004, so I was relatively new at that point. But ever since I've been there, there's been conversation about the whole concept of executive compensation and pay for performance. We do have we've updated these principles. Again, they're not mandatory, but they are principles that the CEOs of the Business Roundtable agree to. They think these are good guidelines by which they should view executive compensation approaches. And as I said, pay for performance, transparency, looking at the long-term shareholder interest are very, very important. Each of the companies will, implement them in their own ways. And many have, assigned lead directors for their compensation committees, which I think is a best practice, and I think that's a growing practice. I think 90% of the Business Roundtable companies have 80% independent directors. And I think that's grown over the course of time. So I think those are steps that companies have taken and will continue to take going forward. And I think there's always a lot that can be learned from global businesses as well. And we have our conversations with counterparts in the European Roundtable of Industrialists and the Kadan Ren in Japan and the Council of Indian Industries and the Canadian Council on Chief Executives and people from all over the world that are chief executives. We do try to compare notes in a fairly regular basis so they can learn from each other and help us learn here in the United States as well.
Well, quick follow-on question, Larry, to that in terms of this the possible conversations that were going on within Business Roundtable from 04 to 06. I mean, what could you share with us in some degree of candor about perhaps some of the Business Roundtable, maybe small table discussions that go on that say, man, we sure missed that one, or, gee, we got egg on our face, we should have seen that coming, or, boy, we didn't see it coming, or I don't know, whatever. I'm just wondering what kinds of conversations are going on about, you know, we missed that one and we don't want to spend all our time in the rearview mirror because life is always in the forward direction. But what kinds of bitter lessons, perhaps? I'm sure a number of the Business Roundtable are financial services companies. In fact, I know Ernst & Young, Jim Turley was here recently. Mm-hmm. He's a CEO of Ernst & Young. And anyway, what can you share with us about some of the soul-searching that's been going on?
Well, I think if anybody knew that September 2008 would occur, things may have, you know, people may have done things differently 4, 5, 6 years ago, but it sort of happened. And as you were asking me the questions, I mean, I kept thinking about, we have a CEO Economic Outlook Survey that we ask our CEOs to fill out quarterly. It looks at, you know about this? Have you looked on the website? We ask the CEOs to give us their perspective on, for 6 months going forward, what are you going to do? Is CapEx going to increase, decrease, stay the same? Sales going to increase, decrease, stay the same? Employment, increase, decrease, stay the same? And what's your estimate of the growth rate of the economy? It's a diffusion index. Anything above 50 is expansionary. Anything below 50 is contraction. And if you look back at the survey, it was all above 50, and I mean, way above 50, for many, many, many quarters. It may dip down a little bit, but always above 50. So when September happened, I think people were feeling the slowdown in the United States, but the international market was continuing to keep things going. It was really keeping the engine of American business going to a large degree. So it's good that we're part of the international economy. In December this past year, December 2008, when we did our survey, again, I'd never seen a survey below 50 because it's always been expansionary since 2004. In December, you know what the survey was? 16.5. It's the lowest in the history of Business Roundtable CEO Economic Outlook. So I don't think people realized what was coming. I think you saw bits and pieces of the U.S. economy slowing down for whatever reason. Then this thing happened. But the other point is, and this is just anecdotal, but if you're a really smart mathematician or somebody coming out of graduate school and you had your choice of sectors to go to, many people chose the financial sector. You had some pretty smart people thinking up some pretty incredible, complex instruments. And imagine being a regulator in Washington, D.C., trying to understand and manage what these people had invented. Because they're really smart people that got attracted because they got paid a lot of money, got rewarded, and it all sort of made sense at that time. It's only looking backward do we learn. But we have to learn, and that's okay to take a stop and learn and figure out, now where are you going to go? And it's one thing if you say, oh, no, we don't have to do anything. Let's just have business as usual. But I think business CEOs have said, time out, we need to do something. We want to work with the government. We want to work with anybody who can help us figure this out. But we have the confidence in ourselves and our companies to actually think that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, the glass is half full. It's not half empty.
Hi, I'm Joanna Jordan Wu, and I am interested in hearing more details on your proposals for the lifelong learning as well as preventative care that seemed like, and I only heard a few details in your presentation, but it sounded like you wanted a portion of that to be provided by companies. I'm a little concerned about that because my understanding is that a typical worker has a very short longevity at any particular company. So the incentive for a particular company to invest in training and health of a particular worker may not, at a lot of companies, calculate.
No, that's a good point. I think there's been a large conversation about, and I forgot what the statistic is, you know, that if a person's 25 years old, they're going to hold 7 different jobs by the time they're
careers.
50 or 60. Careers. There we go. Exactly. That's right. We were talking earlier in your career.
Mm-hmm.
So portability is certainly an issue that people have talked about. And what our companies have tried to do on the matter of wellness, for example, is to, we have a book, and I believe it's on our website, about wellness best practices. So we're not telling everybody how to go do a wellness program. You know, we have 17 people in the roundtable staff. The CEOs pretty much know what their agenda is, but they all have their own individual company shared experiences they can bring to the table. So what Caterpillar may do may be different than ExxonMobil or Verizon or companies. And so, you know, we don't have the ABCs for wellness program, but we do have we have best practice examples. You can see what companies are doing, if that makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, I have seen some examples that sound really great. I guess, sorry, a little follow-up. I'm more concerned about the roundtable's role in trying to encourage policy. Mm-hmm. And if the policies are designed to rely on companies providing some of these services, mm-hmm. then some companies are going to be great, but there may also be a lot of large cracks where mm-hmm. where the math doesn't compute financially right. for companies to invest.
No, good point. Well, we believe, many of our companies believe, that actually the benefits they have are competitive advantage. So if you're a company with great benefits that are reliable and sustainable, when you're looking at a career change, you're going to say, that's very interesting. I like the way that company's doing it versus the way another company's doing it. And so I think you have to look at it from that perspective. We need a healthy employer-based system for all sorts of reasons, from competition to creativity to innovation. And the more people that you have in the system, the more creative markets can occur. When I say that, you know, everybody has an obligation, that means that everybody should. There's a piece that everybody should actually go figure out what to do about healthcare and access the system. The more people you have in the system, the more options can develop. If people don't participate in the system where it's just a one-size-fits-all, that's not good news. It's not optimal for anyone, whether it's cost or efficiency or quality or anything. So that's that. You had a question about the lifelong learning program as well. And you wanted what, more specifics on that?
Sorry. Just along the same lines, that companies may have an incentive to provide short-term types of training to get you to learn a particular thing for your job, but not.
Yeah, I think the distinction I'm making is every company will have its own sort of training plans and approaches. I think the program I'm talking about, that we're suggesting here, is really the federally funded or the government-funded programs that need to be flanged up a bit more efficiently and effectively. $130 billion, you have a pot of money that's being spent on a lot of good programs, but are they efficiently, you know, stitched up together in the right way? But what companies can do, like they do on healthcare, is compare notes. I mean, it's when you get a bunch of companies in the room and they're sharing best practices, you can bet your dollar that they're going to go back home if they heard a good idea and take it to their company, and that's how you get this sort of virtuous improvement in the among companies.
My name is Donald Vandermark. I don't want to put you on the spot, but it's understandable that most business executives and people in the country were surprised by the meltdown in the financial markets. But Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who run Berkshire Hathaway, who are well known the world over, started warning all of us as early as the 1990s about derivative markets and about this shadow banking system.
Right.
Buffett himself called them weapons of mass financial destruction. Charlie Munger was quoted as saying at one annual meeting that that these were compared to sewage, and he said this gives sewage a bad name. So we were warned. Mm-hmm. And the financial services companies, namely the big banks, have a lot to answer for, and I think that's one key reason why there's so much outrage among the American public. I am interested in lifelong learning because I think that the Business Roundtable has really struck on something very, very important there. My question is, does that program have any emphasis or focus on helping individuals understand their own motivations? And this addresses specifically this issue of people with seven careers in a lifetime, because so often what happens is that an employee, a very good employee, changes their own goals, their own lifelong motivations shift, and a company isn't there to answer for it. So it would behoove, particularly these big corporations who are interested in keeping talent, at understanding what the individual really is hoping to achieve and therefore keeping them engaged within the corporation.
Greg, well, so, let me respond to the two questions. I agree on point number one. There's something broken about the excessive risk, and finally the chickens came home to roost, to mix metaphors. It was rewarded for many, many years. People kept taking increasingly incremental more risks, and it was rewarded, and more incremental risk, and it was rewarded, more incremental risk, and it was rewarded. And finally, something happened. Whereas a set of very smart people said, you know, at some point, this has all got to end. And so, again, we have to figure out, what do we do from here? You mentioned the derivative markets. We're going to have to figure out, how do you regulate some of this? You know, right now there's a conversation about where does this fall? I mean, at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or the SEC or some other entity, and do you combine all these agencies that are looking at different parts of the financial mechanisms that work, and how do you put that together in the United States? How do you put that together that works globally? So point taken, but I guess that's why, you know, Warren Buffett is where Warren Buffett is and why others are where they are. On the point of lifelong learning, you make an excellent point, and I wish that I could come here and say we had all the answers on this. All we know is this is a huge problem or a huge opportunity that the CEOs have come upon, because they've realized the big aha is, you know, shareholders are important, but to make shareholders happy, you have to have a company that's really humming along with people that are making things work, and so. You have that whole piece going on. And you have the piece of there's a lot of training, there's a lot of good, well-intentioned programs out there that need to work more efficiently. So this commission, and we're hoping that these smart people that come together, and again, this is not a commission that's going to go on for decades and years. It's supposed to be 6 months, okay? So this year, where they're going to get together a few times and figure some things out, and hopefully this kind of idea will be in the conversation. And if it's not, and if you, as we put on the website, who's on the commission, again, please keep the ideas going or connect with them in some way so they get that thought into the discussion. If it's missed there and it's a great thought, it'll get put in there somewhere, because this is going to be all very much into the public domain.
Larry, I'd like to end on this question, if you would, just comment briefly on the importance of entrepreneurship and innovation. And I find somehow that when all is said and done, quite often more is said than done in that kind of important topic, and everybody talks about it. We've got Carl Schramm, who's the CEO of the Marion Ewing Kauffman Foundation, I think it is, in the Midwest. And they're a foundation renowned around the world with their sole emphasis on entrepreneurship and building that necessary mindset. And certainly we could say that America had its foundations on entrepreneurship, and if we have even one thing going for us, you know, would be that heritage of commercializing ideas, if you will. Anyway, Carl Schramm, when he is here, is going to talk about what he calls a better capitalism in terms of emphasizing entrepreneurial capitalism and applying that to the needs of increasing human welfare. And it's kind of an interesting spin, not to just refer to it as a spin, but please just share with us some last-minute comments as to how the Business Roundtable sees this whole notion of entrepreneurship, which is typically associated with smaller little startups and, you know, small companies, and here are these gigantic companies. But what about entrepreneurship? What about innovation? And what about America's future?
Well, innovation and entrepreneurship is fundamental to having a continuing and prospering society. And that's why people come to America, because they know they can actually have a chance to take that idea and have it grow and flourish. I'll give you one little example of what we have at the Business Roundtable, which I think maybe is an insight into the thinking. Because, you know, we always talk about, you know, quarterly profits, and you talk about, you know, you're making money at the end of the year and return to shareholders and these sorts of things, which are all very important. But being part of society is also equally important. We have a program that Chad Holliday, who was the CEO of DuPont, started about 3 years ago called Sea Change. It stands for Society, Environment, and the Economy. And what it's really meant to do is to say to each company, what are you doing, that whether it involves society, involves the economy someplace, the environment, water, particularly focus on water programs, that you're being creative, that you can actually measure, and that you make transparent. Because those are the kinds of ideas and innovation that people will learn from and from each other and hopefully spring new industries, new businesses, help quality of life in the communities in which companies work. So I think that there's still a lot of hope for entrepreneurship and innovation in America, in America's companies, big companies and small companies. It doesn't have to necessarily be from the CEO, but the CEO has to allow the environment in a company to be such that, you know, you get the great ideas. You know, I was here in, I think, 1998 when I worked for BP, or 99, and John Brown, who was the CEO of BP at the time, gave a speech at Stanford on climate change. And he said, you know, something's happening here, and we need to do something. We need to take precautionary action. And he invited every employee to send him an email with ideas on how to reduce emissions. Very powerful. So multiply that times 160 companies and having an environment where innovation and ideas are welcome. And that's what will keep America great. Thank you.
I want to thank Larry Burton, Executive Director of the Business Roundtable based in Washington, D.C., for coming and sharing some terrific insights with us. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.